Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is part 2 of episode 11 on Culture and High Reliability by Bierley and Spender. If you haven't listened to part 1, please go and do so before continuing on, as this is a direct continuation of that discussion. Now back to the episode. Before we get back to the episode though, we are currently looking for someone to help us out developing our blog. So if you're interested, please do get in touch with us or go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com to find out more. As always, you can also get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, and on LinkedIn. All right, enjoy the episode.
Okay, so I think I would like to go back to Ralph's previous point about the Admiral Ricker, because I think what would be interesting for us is to try to branch out a bit from his visionary nature and all his great work that went into constructing the system, and try to understand more how, what are in a way the mechanisms that are in place, what are the means to get the things accomplished over and over, what does maintain this culture, you know. So acknowledging his important role, but to branch out of a one person story, which is kind of the author's put forward, and try to look more of the system in
a way. I
think
it's a good idea.
So just before we do that though, let's say who this person is.
Admiral Rickover.
Oh yes. Okay.
Admiral Rickover. He's also referred to sometimes as the kindly old gentleman. Yes.
Oh, okay.
So some of my friends in nuclear power will appreciate that reference.
Is that ironic, or is he really like a
real
gentleman?
The kindly part is ironic, but old gentleman was certainly he's certainly a gentleman, and he was old. And then there are but the times when he was kindly were very, very far apart. And most of the time, he was kind of irascible and hard to work with.
So he's the de facto founder of the U.S. nuclear navy, and he's worked as a junior officer on the Manhattan Project, which is, from what I gathered, where he got his insight into the potential of nuclear power from. Correct?
Yes, and he, what's often left out of the biographical information is he actually served in the submarine force World War II, and he was also the chief engineer of a cruiser, the New Mexico, actually, and a lot of the things that you could see Rickover doing later in his career were things that he was practicing and learning when he was in some of those positions. So it's very interesting that he then also his views of reliability were notorious in the Navy and thought to be very picky and difficult. And they authors make a reference to that we'll discuss. But he was famous for somebody would bring him some new piece of hardware, he was during World War II. He was in the electrical distribution section of the Bureau of Ships. So somebody would bring him some new piece of hardware and say, "Hey, we got to put this aboard ship." And the first thing he would do is throw it on the floor. First thing, he'd throw it on the floor, and if he could break it, he would say, "Not satisfactory for use aboard ships." And nobody, you know, used to do things like that. So that's sort of Rickover's approach to reliability.
It's a very hands-on.
Yes, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. So currently in the Navy, we have a very fancy term for that. We call that shock qualification. So Rickover was his own shock lab.
Okay, so.
So you talk about these things that Rickover did. And then he was famous for testifying in front of the Three Mile Island Commission that it was not the success that the nuclear Navy had achieved in performance and reliability wasn't just due to military context or, you know, the personnel, but it was basically a system, you know, of careful selection of highly intelligent and motivated people who were thoroughly trained and then held personally accountable for performance to a standard. And so I think that's one of the things you were talking about, Pedro, was the fact that it's not just this guy's personality, it's the fact that he's going to create a system to hold people accountable. Yeah, and in fact, so I want to just expand on that briefly and then I'd like to get your reaction. So Rickover was famous for saying this, and we actually have a lot of Rickover sayings that we still kind of repeat regularly in the nuclear Navy because they're very applicable. And one good example is you get what you inspect, not what you expect. And that's a very nice, compact statement. The fact that that the nuclear Navy, you're expected to get out of your office and away from your desk and go see what things really look like to have an understanding of what's going on. And another one, Rickover has a famous description of responsibility, and I don't have it right here in front of me, so I'm just going to have to paraphrase it. But essentially, what Rickover said was, unless you can point your finger in the chest of the person who's responsible for something when it goes wrong, then you never really had anybody responsible. And I think that starts out with responsibility is a unique concept. So if anybody wants to Google that, they can just do Rickover, responsibility is a unique concept, and blam, it will come right up. And so I'd like to get your reaction to that one, Pedro.
Yeah, well, I love that. But I'm going to, I think in order to get more about this personal level accountability, I think we have to understand a bit where is this coming from. And what I really like here is, as I said before, they talk about culture in a very concrete terms. And they talk about specifically about the selection of the personnel, which is something that I think thus far, none of the authors emphasize so much, because there's a lot about control and designing the tasks and, I don't know, the way you manage them, what system is placed. But rarely we talk about how these people enter there. And not only that, once they enter, what kind of training you give them and what kind of specific, I would say, like normative rules and norms you try to instill, what kind of stories are heard around, which are always, you know, to make organizations function, you know. And it's in a way, it's very reminiscent to the context I was watching again on complex product development, in which I also knew interesting stories about selection, how much they really strive to have this very, you know, best class engineers, and they train them extensively on the job to understand what it is to be an engineer in that context, what they expect from the person, how much they expect exactly this, this questioning attitude.
Yes, so let's tease that apart just a little bit, because I think that's a great observation. So Rickover was one of the first to realize that nuclear power was very different. It's not just a different way to boil water. It was a very different technology. And Rickover used to talk a lot about having respect for technology and what technology could do. And so he developed this selection process that had many facets to it. So one facet was this idea that you're specially selecting people and you have to, you know, demonstrate to the admiral. There's actually a rigorous selection process you go to before you even get to the admiral. And the admiral can look at the results of these prior interviews that you've done before. And so he knows what they are. And some of the interview processes, you get criticism for your performance in the prior interviews. And Rickover he did not tolerate people who had really big egos. And so there's a famous case of a senior officer coming to become part of the program. He eventually became the chief of naval operations. That's that most senior officer in the U.S. Navy. And he started trying to quote Aristotle and Plato to Rickover. And Rickover got furious because he felt like he knew it better than this other guy did. And he thought he was being pretentious. And so he got put in the broom closet a couple times because Rickover was trying to make a point. And so there's this sort of trial by fire aspect that these interviews had that's probably less so now. But the other thing is, so Peter, you were talking about this, the selection process and how people could kind of look back at it. These interviews very much made people feel like they were different than everybody else and fostered a sense of esprit de corps. Because you faced the kindly old gentleman, you know, and you got yelled at and had to do some kind of strange thing. And so, because a lot of the interviews, they just touched, just scratched the surface, were unexpected things. You know, you just never knew what Rickover was going to ask you. And so those were some of the, like, these famous stories. And so maybe your interview was more common than some of the others, but you would tell these stories to perpetuate this idea that, hey, we're a cut above because we got through this, you know, this interview process. So I think that's an important part of the selection process and making people feel special.
So an anecdote before I start, because In the university I went to in Italy, they have a design school that was very special for some reasons. And one of the interesting things was they had a selection process that was very unique. And in a way, when they did the interview, they all threw different, you know, situations as the person that wanted to enter the school. So they would ask them to catwalk on this table or, you know, improvise a theater piece or do anything. And people felt a bit nervous because, you know, they said, like, that's not really about design and anything. But what the people justified is that, you know, you never really know what you're going into when you have, like, a new design challenge and you are about to create new things and you have to be able to think on your feet. And we can never teach that. We can only help you to hone your skills. But we have to have people that are able, you know, to be creative and think and like, challenge things. So it's just like to bring from a complete, very complex technology to a different, complete environment that still values, I'm going to say, I don't want to say creativity, but, you know, like this kind of independent thinking. Because I see that this spirits the corpse, as you said, which is, you know, like going back to the old Fayol, it's very interesting. You can read that not so much as this in-group attitude, as, you know, like, oh, we are better, we did that. But it's more about, oh, we are the guys that really are, you know, able to think by ourselves. No, we are the ones that, you know, we can deal with unexpected things.
Yes, yes.
You see what I'm trying to say? So it becomes less about being an elite, but it's being about, okay, we are the ones that can handle unexpected situations. And that fosters that kind of a general feeling, no?
No, it does. And this is pervasive through, I think, a lot of all but perhaps very menial work. To me, I can't, I don't know, I have very ambivalent attitudes towards this sort of elitism, because I can't stop thinking about what professional services firms and management consultancies are infamous for doing now, in that the trial by fire consists of relentless work hours and, basically working through the night overnight. And it's just, I personally have a negative attitude towards that kind of a working culture where, and in this famous work that I think you alluded to, The Engineering Culture by Kunde, that we'll consider in its own right sooner or later, they mentioned that too, that this idea that you kind of sacrifice a part of yourself or push the boundary of what would be, you know, humanly expected of you, that is a good thing. And it's not that you would do that for your own personal development, it's you thus show your loyalty to the tribe, and unless you do that, then you don't make it on the inside. Basically, this weird, anachronistic, you know, antiquated way of showing that, of conformity, really. I think maybe that's what bugs me the most there, that it's a self-destructive way of conforming to the, you know, the idea that may or may not have any semblance to reality.
Well, I think you're pointing out the dark side of that, Dimitris, that organizations can use it to take advantage of or get extra work out of their employees, because it's this esprit de corps thing, and, you know, we can put in 18-hour days or 20-hour days, and you'll do it just because you believe in the organization. I agree with you. I think that's excessive, and it's almost like the reaction you're starting to see now in medical schools, where we're starting to realize, you know, maybe it's not such a smart idea to have doctors who are doing what we in the U.S. call internships, where they're not a fully doctor and it's part of their practice session portion of their education and training, to be working 36-hour, you know, days or shifts, because people don't make good decisions after about 18 or 19 hours. And so some of this is, it carries sort of this rite of passage hazing aspect to it, which does not really, I mean, there's a little bit of that in nuclear power, but I do think it is something to be cautious about.
I can just say one thing, that I agree with Dimitri as well, but I think that's almost like, if you imagine this like graphic, I would say there is spirit, the corpse in a row, and like there are two columns, and one can be about how the working condition, and the other about the socialization and the selection, as we're saying. Because I think one thing is when it creates this kind of, as you're saying, this elite in-group in which you're expected to, you know, live or die for that commitment. And sometimes, as you said, the organization may take advantage of that and just like suck everything that they can out of the employees. But there is also the other dimension in which I think we're referring and might fit the general idea of high reliability organizations. Is that you create a specific kind of value within a larger organization. What I understand is this case here, that you want people to be very questioning, whereas in gender military ethos, that is not so present. And that was things that that was with my example with the university, that you know, students are expected to know. They think that they have to give the answer that the professor wants or what they want that's in the books. And in the case of what I was illustrating in the design school, is that these people want the students to be able to come up with their own answers in a way, because, you know, there are always so many ways in which you can design a website or a product, and there is like there is nothing that you can come from books so much. So you see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with this pre-decor or this unorthodox way of testing. In fact, I welcome that. Maybe not in the Fayolian sense, that if you recall, this pre-decor was literally dismemberment of an individual from themselves. But it's when this becomes a self-perpetuating thing, that a norm, if you will, that is not necessarily endorsed by the organization, or at least not actively countered. So as the case with hospitals, you know, that's not desirable. But when this is an emergent property of the culture, that is when I start having issues with this weird, you know, masochistic way of approaching work, and more importantly, status within a particular working environment. But that's, I think that's taking us away from the high reliability aspect.
No, but I think my contention here is that, you know, I like Kunda, but I really disagree with him that he has a very all dark picture of what happens when you control culture, you know, and it's like, my point is that can be otherwise. You can engineer culture, you can try to, you know, instill certain norms and values that can actually, you know, help the goal of the organization without completely, in a way, you know, taking a toll on the worker's life.
Yeah, I agree with you. So one thing I want to talk about a little further in just the recovery section is some of the areas where I think the authors are either leaving something out overstating things. So for example, they have a statement on page 651 where they talk about what Rickover believed, you know, that the real danger lay in concealing mistakes, but they don't give a citation. So I wonder, well, how do you guys know what he believed if you're not really citing something that he said? Now in fact, that is true that in the Navy nuclear, I couldn't say about the Rickover part of it, but I could say in the Navy nuclear power program, concealing mistakes is just about one of the worst things you can do, because it's akin to lying. Basically not telling the truth. And so that'll get you kicked out of the program very rapidly, is if it looks like you're trying to hide mistakes that you made, because you have to be open and we have to be transparent. So really it's about transparency. So sort of a quibble there. But they do talk about later. So related to culture here, because it says the naval reactors culture provides a framework within which individuals can, and they give this list. And my rejoinder to that is, well, that's more of the Navy nuclear power program culture, not just naval reactors. It's how we approach that in general. And they have a nice list there that I think were applicable to high reliability work in any kind of organization. And it's monitor, advise, criticize, and support each other, right? So there's that kind of questioning attitude, thinking, you know, being open to outside influence or examination. And then the last one, under circumstances of high stress, when mistakes are made or when surprises or failures or malfunctions occur, you know, that it basically supports people in those kinds of circumstances. And so when you look at that list, you don't have to say, oh, that's nuclear power, or, you know, that's aviation. That's a lot of organizations are like that, right? So that's why I think it can apply to other organizations and not just those in high-risk work.
Well, I think that's an interesting point to discuss.
Yep.
The way how this can be applied to other organizations. And I think healthcare is an obvious choice. But something that I'm puzzled by is, so this branch of the military and healthcare and air traffic control, those kind of things, they have a very specific, very service oriented ethos that you are there to do that. But what about more, I don't know how to characterize them, maybe more professional services, things like, well, I guess university isn't necessarily an organization that requires high reliability, but construction that is more project based, so you don't actually have a whole organization there to train in this way, or law enforcement, there's many things that can be improved through high reliability principles, but I'm not saying that it's not the case, but I would be very curious to see how these principles can be applied in the absence of having this, almost unitary direction and approach to culture and work and how things are supposed to be done.
Well, and that's the challenge. The hospitals and law enforcement and those kinds of organizations do have some of those kind of challenges, but I would say they're just a different mix of what gets centralized and where local discretion is allowed. And I'm actually working with a person now who does law enforcement training and application of deadly force and when to pull your weapon out and those kinds of things. And there are guidelines for the officers, about those kinds of things, but they don't apply to all, circumstances. The challenge, I would say, for law enforcement and less so for medical now, but law enforcement's a good example where you're kind of by yourself unless you have a partner out there. So you're not working in a team like a lot. And so that sort of watch team backup or support that you get in high reliability organizations isn't as prevalent. So it's harder in those kinds of circumstances. But even then, the law enforcement officials are instructed about, how to deal with crowds and manage people external to the actual, specific law enforcement situation or getting backup and such. And so I think the challenge in those kind of cases is how do you adapt the principles? Because you just can't run those things like nuclear submarines. And to me, one of the things that I think is really important is this idea about being able to develop some kind of shared culture and a way of examining performance, right? So I just gave you that list, monitor, advise, criticize, and support each other. In many organizations, that's all done informally or not at all. That basically just people go out doing their thing and things happen, but they don't get talked about with people. There's not a way to report problems and, common issues. And so that's a form of organizational learning, right? The monitoring, advising, and criticizing and supporting. And so many organizations struggle with how to build in some kind of organizational learning because that actually is one of the keys of high reliability, but it's not the only one, certainly.
I just realized that perhaps I should paraphrase my question, or rather, listening to what you said, I think I realized what exactly is it that that I'm trying to get at. Is in the example of the nuclear submarine, or even a nuclear reactor, the entire work is based around maintaining that platform, whatever it may be. But the situations where there is no platform around which to structure work, where maybe the object of work is other people or a number of different technologies, I think it may be, or rather I'm curious, to what extent it is different to establish a high reliability system where you don't have a system around which to make it. Does that make sense?
I think it does, and that's one of the challenges of applying high reliability or the principles in other contexts. So I think the analog for healthcare, if I understand it correctly, because I have looked at this and talked to people in healthcare about applying high reliability, the analog in healthcare is safety of the patient, right? So in the case of nuclear power, you're trying to protect the reactor and anything that can cause all this kind of damage. Well, in healthcare, their overriding desire is not to harm the patient through their practices. And so I don't think that's a huge stretch to say, okay, well, you can practice a lot of the same stuff once you say that's the outcome you're trying to achieve is, you know, no unconscious harm to the patient. Right. I'm not trying to make it sound simple, but that's actually one of the ways you look at it.
No, I think that's very insightful because then it becomes a matter of posing the objective of the organization in an appropriate way. For healthcare, it would be safety of the patient. For nuclear reactors, it would be public safety. Then it gets tricky in some places. What would it be for educational institution, for instance? Would it be giving the best type and variety of knowledge available now, or would it be, as is common criticism with universities, achieving employment rates with the graduates?
So I think what Dimitri is trying to get at is that within organizations there are always multiple goals going on. In healthcare, we can see the example. So you probably can imagine that for the doctors, you know, the whole thing is about, you know, like getting the patients better and improving and blah blah. The people with admin is more about, you know, meeting certain targets maybe. And so there is always like this multiple variety of goals that people are pursuing. So what I hear that Ralph is proposing is that in order to, you know, really use these lessons from hybrid ability organizations, we have to find the common denominator that brings the different tasks and work of these people together. Is that what I'm hearing from both of you?
It's a little different. So it's close. I think the thing you start is, well, what's the most important thing to you in the organization? What's the primary good you're trying to achieve? And so I gave you the example from healthcare. So I'll give you another example, and I'll come back to education. So, and education's a hard one. So that's probably wouldn't be my favorite place to start, but there are actually organizations, and I've heard of them in Southern California and other places in the United States, who are actually trying to apply the principles to education. It's generally at the what we call the kindergarten or K through 12 through high school before universities, because university is a really big challenge. But so let me go back to perhaps I just came from a conference in Canada on petroleum and gas exploration and drilling. And they, one of the things they talk about is it's a very interesting idea. They say, well, if we're out there and just basically throwing caution to the winds and it's only about profit, very quickly we're going to have spills and accidents and hurt people. And the regulators are going to come down on us and make the work very expensive and hard to do, which is going to be a problem for us. So they have incentive on two levels. One is to basically show they can be more effective and safer regulating themselves to achieve safe outcomes. And in oil and gas, that's it's basically protect the environment so you don't have big spills and fires and that kind of thing, and also protect your workforce, you know, have because of the occupational safety and health kinds of issues. So they've decided they need to get ahead of the regulators and not wait for the regulation to just tell them what to do, because it's not enough to maintain their reputation, and their business actually depends on that. So the last thing I want to say about that before I pause for questions and then move into the sort of statement about education, so the challenges is they've decided that that reputational capital or that social license is very important, and therefore they've moved from saying, well, I got to make money, you know, cost and schedule and cost and money, profits, everything. They've now said, well, actually, no, you're not going to be in business very long if that's the way you operate, because you're going to get shut down by the regulators or lawsuits when you get things wrong. So now what they're starting to say is safety, protecting the environment, and profit are co-equals, right? They're not more important. No one is more important than the other, but basically, if you just said, well, I'm going to focus on one of those three things at the exclusion of the others, you're not going to be in business very long. It's not, and so they now talk a lot about sustainability. And so there is this notion that high reliability could help you be more sustainable. Is that in the ballpark of what you guys were talking about?
Okay, I was going in a different direction because I'm trying to get out of certain assumptions of high reliability organizations. Because you went back to safety, I would say, Ralph. You know, we talk about safety of the patient and, you know, the general... I'm going to say creating this safe system in the oil and gas industry. But if you think that, you know, organisms have a general goal and they are machines to, in a way, deliver that. So I was going more towards Toyota and all this kind of processes mapping in which you try to clarify what is you're trying to achieve. And then once that is clear in the heads of everyone, you actually enable them to be more question oriented and to really be sure that their own tasks and the tasks they're involved in, the tasks they see around them, are contributing to that or not. You see, like, I'm trying to take like a deeper general lesson, but I don't know if I'm forcing too much. Okay.
I agree with you. I think that's a great point. And so remember earlier on, I talked about you have to decide what's the important outcomes you're trying to achieve. And but even in Toyota's case, right, it's not just when you look at the high reliability aspect, it's not just producing a car that runs better and gets better gas mileage, right? Toyota suffered significant reputational capital damage because they were fudging, you know, the safety statistics, right? And so huge reputational impact because they weren't being transparent and they were hiding things. And then same thing with the unintended acceleration. Yeah, you could put a safety label on that, but it comes down to this reputational capital and social license that corporations have. I mean, you know, you want to talk about social license, look at Mitsubishi and Volkswagen, you know, suffering huge losses and big financial impacts as well. So safety is a part of that, but it's not the only thing you care about. So I think you can translate it to other important outcomes because you got to just say, because really what is Toyota in the business of? Just assembling cars? Or do they have to have public confidence that they produce something that's, you know, that's going to, I don't get the family protection thing, but, you know, that, but they're also going to do it in a sustainable environmental way. I mean, you company like that cannot afford to take shots to their reputation on any of those fronts.
I see. So it's almost like, I don't know, preventing errors, but in a very big way. I don't know how to phrase that in English, to be honest.
I would say not necessarily preventing errors, but understanding the risks. And then dialing up your procedures. So at one level, you know, producing bad cars, poor quality cars, that's a risk, right? So that's kind of what you were talking about. But then I was talking about the other dimensions of risk, because that's what HRO is when you're engaged in really high risk work or work where you've got some vulnerabilities, you got to pay attention to stuff like that. And so HROs look at those and how to balance all that stuff together.
So how one would set up or think of setting up or introducing or implementing or any of those sort of things, high reliability principles, is then based on what we just discussed, and do correct me, is then first you need to realize what is your central object of work, or basically what are the key outcomes you're looking for, then figure out what is the criteria for achieving them, not necessarily in a strict way, but still, and then come up with what are the personal and social qualities that you would need to develop or look for in the workforce to achieve the object of work.
And I think that's a good summary. And I think the scholarship in high reliability organizing tells you what some of those principles are. So it doesn't, you know, the real key there is you have to just contextualize them for your particular circumstance. So this balancing, you know, verbatim compliance with questioning attitude, respect for authority, but also backing people up if you think they're getting it wrong. Transparency, which I talked about, was very important. You know, having high standards of technical and social skills. So yes, I think that's one of the values of the research is it's not all just you have to go figure it out every single time. It's, hey, here's these principles that are common. They're just implemented, I think, as Pedro was talking about. They're kind of implemented in different ways.
Okay. Just one last thing. Since we banged so much on this concept of object of work, do we want to define that, Dimitri, a bit?
Nah.
No.
What I mean when I say object of work is something akin to what is the purpose towards which the organization exists, and or part of the organization, and it may be there or it may not be there. I think we wouldn't be surprised if I said that a number of organizations seemingly exist to no purpose at all. But if we come back to the Barnard episodes, I think he presents an extensive discussion on effectiveness. Effectiveness had to do with the purpose of the organization. It doesn't have to be static. It can change over time and space. But it is basically that towards which all of the things that we're doing are completed.
Okay, that's good. So now I'm going to challenge, not challenge, but I want to engage with Ralph on that issue of transparency, because I think we all would agree that, you know, this whole idea of monitoring advice and the questioning attitude is all great. But the problem is like, okay, so how do you get that to happen? And what kind of ongoing incentives exist for that to happen, you know, beyond just socialization, get the right people and like having the stories around and learning? Because, you know, learning from mistakes is important. And I mean, to go to the case of the hospitals, there's a lot of, you know, procedures and standards that have been implemented in a way to, you know, lead hospitals to learn from mistakes. But there are studies that show that, you know, for a number of reasons, it's just because, you know, one of like ticking the box game again. And that doesn't really happen. So maybe we could like wonder a bit about that. If like, you know, anything like specific mechanisms from HROs that, you know, ensure that, you know, it's effective.
Yeah. So I don't know about I would use the word ensure effective, but yes, there's actually a principle, and it goes back to this, that concept about you get what you inspect, not what you expect. And so there's this transparency notion. So let me give you an example of how that's done in the Navy. And so what you do is the Navy has a view that says, okay, let's say I have a process like hand washing, for example. So we'll try to make it for hospitals. So we have this, you have a process and it tells people what to go do. And like you said, Pedro, there's done studies that, you know, find out that a lot of people don't get that right, or the, you know, the compliance rate's very low. Well, the Navy's view is, if you don't have a way to audit and evaluate the effectiveness of your process, you don't really have a process. Because the Navy says a process is what people do, not what's just written down, right? So if you don't audit or evaluate or do some kind of study or collect information or talk to people about the process, then all you really do, you have, is a goal. You said, well, we have this goal for people to wash hands. And so the Navy does a lot of that, where we have, whether it's in submarine construction and maintenance, or a nuclear power field, we'll have lots of processes, and we regularly audit them. And of course, it's a judgment call about how many processes you do, how much auditing on. You know, I get it, but it goes back to kind of what Dimitris said, was, well, okay, if we've said here's these outcomes that we want, or these things we want the organization to accomplish, then some of the processes are really, really important to getting that done, and some less so. And so you do some sort of risk benefit or risk analysis that says, okay, well, here's the ones I really have to work on. And then you send people out to actually inspect and audit and collect data. And then they write a report. And then the person who's responsible for that process area has to talk about what corrective actions they're going to go take. And so one of the things that's, I don't want to say inexcusable, but a large red flag or red light, warning signal in the high liability organizations is if you have repeat problems of the same kind. Because what it really means is you're not taking the feedback well, you're not making changes, you're not making adjustments, you're not being dynamic, you know, based on what the risks are. And so that's an example of how you say, okay, well, we have these things in place and we want to make it more transparent. And you, things don't go well for you in a high reliability organization if you have this one of these audits and you say, well, I don't really care what that person said, or it's not important because I'm too busy making money. That is because of the nature, you know, the elevated risk nature of these processes. That's not acceptable response.
Okay, my internet went down for a second, so I missed like part of the example. But from what I understand, is that you're saying that this auditing attitude almost like is a way to ensure that they're going to rethink and continually think what they're doing and if it's fitting what you're supposed to be doing, blah 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 blah. But the issue is that, from what I read, this is more like, you know, promoted an attitude from outside, and it's not so much the attitude from within, which is more what I'm interested in, which is, you know, in the case of the selection and the training that these people receive. So there is the idea you have to be someone that is able to question, you know, think on your feet, and so on and so forth. And so I was wondering if there is any kind of, you know, incentives, but incentives, you know, like praises that someone receives that say, oh no, so if you're a questioning person, that's good. You know, people say, oh no, he's such a a critical person, or, you know, like if that kind of informal dimension in the system to keep that value, to show how important that value is and should be nurtured, exist. So
yes,
it's more like
absolutely.
This level.
Okay. Yeah, so it does exist. It's but now you're talking social systems, which are idiosyncratic throughout the Navy. So sometimes some ships will do that and some ships won't. I made a point of doing that regularly, is basically rewarding people and telling them they did a good job and pointing out that when they had a questioning attitude, it was a good thing. And to demonstrate to people that mattered to me. And yeah, you didn't have to give the person money or extra time off or anything like that. Just sometimes basically calling them to the front of the room of their peers and saying, hey, what this person did was really impressive. And look, this is what they did and this is why it's important. And that sends a very strong cultural signal. So yeah, that happens pretty regularly. There's a lot of that internal stuff going on. And then even the auditing is done internally, right? So I wasn't clear enough about that. So not only do external auditors come down, but one of the first things the external auditors will say is, what internal audits have you done on this system? And show me what you found and show me what you've done about them. So one of the things could be, one of their findings could be, you don't have a robust process to critically analyze yourself, or you're not following up on these audits and assessments. And so it's an external view of the internal view they sometimes do, right? So that's actually very important.
I'm really glad you asked about incentives, because this is an acknowledged, it's not, first of all, it doesn't come through in the paper as much. And when it does, it comes through as an acknowledged paradox of the system, that on the one hand, it demands total commitment, but on the other hand, you have this very almost rigid control over how problems are solved, and there's procedures and everything. So and then the authors go on to say that the turnover is actually quite a problem, because people after a certain level seem to want to go to a place where they can put more of their individuality through into their work, which seems to be not as possible in high reliability organizations. So I'm really happy you asked that. And what you said, Ralph, it's on the one hand, it's great that you did that, but on the other hand, if you someone who wouldn't take the time and effort to praise people for doing the work correctly, you know, to do the work as is expected from them, I think it can be a significant issue in terms of motivating someone to put in this much effort and almost selfless commitment. There's this whole phase of cooperation thing going on there.
You're absolutely correct. And so one of the things we used to say, at least one of the observations I made, was that a lot of the things you do in high reliability organizations require, like you said, Demetrius, near selfless devotion. I mean, not quite, but pretty close. And many times they're not really inherently motivating. It goes towards the point that Pedro was making. And so there are some organizations that don't do it very well. I mean, even in the U.S. Navy, there's a lot of variability, as you would expect, from one submarine to another. The authors don't really touch on that sort of dark side aspect of it, other than talking about the people leaving because they didn't want to suppress their imagination and creative talents. Now, I would argue there's plenty of room for imagination and creative talents, but they do have to be channeled, right? You just can't do anything you want. So I practiced all, I wouldn't have been able to stay in the Navy if I wasn't able to find outlets in the organizations and in high reliability for creativity and imagination. But a lot of people don't see it that way. And so that's one of the things I considered a big challenge as a senior leader in the organization, was helping people see that there's aspects where you can contribute your creativity, but not everywhere. And also realize that, yes, it's a lot of the behaviors are not inherently rewarding. So you have to kind of look elsewhere, and pride in workmanship and the quality of the work you do and getting good results and teamwork and those kinds of things. Because, that kind of teamwork that exists in submarines, for example, the closest analog in a professional work situation in that's widely recognized is sports teams. You know, where everybody's pulling for each other, and everybody, is considered, key member of a team, and you depend on each other, not quite life and death like you do on a submarine, but close, you know, in sports teams with you know, people consider the stakes very high. And a lot of people will say after they leave the Navy, there was nothing like that. They have never seen, ever had work that was, you know, even approximated that, that sort of camaraderie and team spirit. And that's actually one of the things you tell people is one of the benefits of, you know, that kind of an organization. But, you know, it's not like it's its own reward. It's a challenge.
Yeah, that's completely amazing. And there is this aspect that needs to be considered when thinking of applying kind of more military-ish, I guess, more camaraderie-type organizational designs and systems, or maybe even motivations to more normal, I suppose, organizations. And that's why it's really amazing that we had you here to share your experiences and opinions with us. So what was the best part of this paper for you? What do you think, Pedro?
Okay, so what I'd like to say is that this text really challenged some of my assumptions, and it was great to have an inside perspective from Ralph, actually. Now, I think that general management and organizational studies have much to learn from that context, and I look forward to read more about HROs and the relation between organizational structure and social dynamics. And I guess that my takeaway lesson is that high reliability organizations are reliable not despite people, but because of people. In particular, I liked the idea of how personal accountability is important in a well-defined organizational structure, while the general ideas of bureaucracy only stress responsibility, you know, of the role and leave the informer in the shadows. Here, we see a case in which structures are put in place to also organize informal relations, or what you may even call culture.
I really enjoyed how hands-on it was, and that intrigued me very much. And if that intrigued you as well, our listeners, then we are going to have another episode on high reliability things with two very special guests to be announced.
Okay, so stay tuned for more.
And that's all for episode 11. Thank you for listening. Next week, we're going to have a summary, and if you enjoyed listening and learning about high reliability organizing, we have another episode scheduled for end of year that we'll announce shortly with two very special specialists guests from the field of high reliability organizing. So that's very exciting. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a positive review on iTunes or any other platform. These help new listeners find us, and it helps a lot. And as usual, tell your friends. The podcast has been growing at an amazing pace, and so thank you so much for listening. And we are keen to continue with this and get more people talking about organizations. Next time, we present a special episode from the Organizational Learning, Knowledge and Capabilities Conference that Ralph and myself attended at the end of April in St. Andrews in Scotland. And that episode features Professors Paul Duguid and Emma Bell. And it's very interesting, and we are talking about the value of conferences and similar such congregations in generating and disseminating and translating knowledge. So I'm very excited to bring you that one. Again, thanks for listening, and hope to see you again.